The following presentation was recorded at a Faith Builders colloquy. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
How does it actually work in a person's life? The person I would like to talk about is a man that lived back in Germany in the early 1700s, by the name of Heinz Beutel. Edsel mentioned the fact that there are times when it seems that the Spirit of God moves in a particular way, in a particular area. At this point, there seemed to be a great need in Germany. It was, remember, I'm talking about the early 1700s, so we're talking about over a century after the Reformation. And this was at the time when the Reformed state churches were largely dead and cold and not getting much done. The Anabaptists had somehow reverted into being much like what they had come out of in many cases, a bunch of powerful men pushing each other around and people suffering the consequences. So there wasn't much there. I'm not sure how are we going to do this here. I was going to draw some maps on the board. I guess I'll just quickly have to do one. Here's these. I'm not sure how well acquainted you are with Germany, but we'll start up at the top here. And we'll start with the port of Stettin, which, if you know anything about Stettin now, it's on the border between modern-day Germany and Poland, which, of course, was not the border back in then. I'll mark Berlin on, which is, of course, the capital of Germany now. I'll mark on a river, which is the Oder River. And I'll mark on a province of Germany, a land of Germany called Schlesien. Now, in English, I think it is often known in modern-day works as Silesia. Silesia or Silesia, I'm not sure how you say it. And then there's another part in here which we call Lausitz in German. And in English, I think this is called Lusatia. Lausitz. All right, now I'll put on a little village here we call Jägendorf. We'll see if all that comes on up on the board now. Okay, this will pass. Here we have Poland. This river here is the modern-day border between Germany and Poland, but the Polish border comes down here. And somewhere down in here we have Czechoslovakia, it's Czech Republic now. And one other name I should have marked on here. Somewhere in Lausitz here, I'll mark on a little village called Hernhu. All right. Now, the part I'm going to talk about in here is this part of Schlesien. They're coming in on this river. This, of course, is lowland country. Once you get up into Berlin, we get into some hilly country. But once you get back in here, there is a high range of mountains coming on down through here, which turns into the Carpathian mountain system. But this part in here is called the Sudetengebirge, which is a chain of mountains along the border between the Czech Republic and Poland at this point. This part in here is called Niederschlesien, which is a low river part with swamps and cane breaks. Up in the northern part, or the higher part, it's actually the southern part, we get into Oberschlesien, which is a higher mountainous region. And down here we have the city of Katowice. Here we have Breslau, which all these places have Polish names by now. And somewhere at Bergen, this Auschwitz camp was in here somewhere during World War II, if you know anything about that. Now here on the southern edge of this little town is actually in the Czech Republic at this point. It's got some Czech name which I can't pronounce. But in German it's called Jägendorf, which means the city of the hunters, or the town of the hunters. And in this part of Schlesien was known as Green Schlesien because of the fact that it was all pine woods up in the mountains. People were industrious. They were German-speaking. They grew linen, and they beat out the linen in the springtime, and the ladies wove linen cloth. I guess you weave linen, don't you? There's a good many linen weavers back in there. And also coal mines. Now, you might not think coal was very important back in those days. It was just becoming important. So here we had the beginnings of German industry back in the early 1700s. But this was a troubled part of Europe. At this point, Germany over here, Prussia, was Protestant, Lutheran, and the country Austria down to the south was Catholic. And this part was being batted back and forth between Germany and Austria during the 30 Years' War, and it ended up Austrian. So Schlesien was an Austrian province, and of course under very strict Roman Catholic rule. In those days, if you weren't a Roman Catholic, you were still liable to get your head chopped off. Although it wasn't quite as prevalent as in Reformation times, but it's still very problematic. Now this Heinz Beutel, as a young man, his parents
had deep suspicions that perhaps the Lutherans were right. They weren't quite sure, but when the Roman Catholic officials, the Austrians, came around and they said, now all of you folks, you need to swear an oath that you will be true to the Pope. It's called the Religionseid. We're talking about religion this morning. You swear this oath that the Pope is right and the church is based in Rome. Everyone here in Schlesien had to swear this oath. Heinz Beutel, as a young man, swore the oath. He went, but he was deeply troubled. How can I say this, he asked himself, if I'm not quite sure? What if I forswear myself and swear to something before God that wouldn't be true? Wouldn't that be awful? So Heinz Beutel was put into a deep personal spiritual confusion. At the point of swearing the oath, he writes this in his own story. We'll get to that later on. He resolved one thing. I must find out what the scriptures say. This was his resolve. I must find out what the scriptures say. Now, in those days, the scriptures, of course, were not popular. The Roman Catholics did not want you to read the scriptures. But and he wasn't at all sure about the Lutherans either. He didn't know what was what. He was confused. I must find out what the scriptures say. Over this time, Heinz's sister Elizabeth was also a seeker after truth. She heard that there were people coming in from Germany, sneaking in the dark, and coming in on trails through the mountains, and meeting in people's homes. Heinz was against it. He thought, this must be something bad. If they'd be good people, they'd do their stuff in public. What's all this about? Come sneaking in here at night and misleading the people, no doubt. And for all you know, there's all sorts of stories going around, witchcraft and whatnot, all these people were into. These people came from a little village over here called Hamhoop. In fact, it was more than a village. It was a Christian community. And these were people, they were pietists. I'll just have to acknowledge this right off. But we're talking here about some pietists. If you don't like pietists, maybe you'll want to leave right now. But these were people that had gotten converted. And they joined up with a very old Christian movement, much older than Anabaptism. And in fact, it's sort of hazy as to where the whole thing began, because there's different stories about how it all was. Some say it began with John Huss, but don't buy that. It's not altogether true. This movement down here was known as the Moravian movement, the Märische Brüder in German. Well, these people were in here, and they very definitely sought Christ. There's no doubt about it. They may have been wrong in a lot of things, but they did seek Christ. These were people that were coming over here into Schlesien and evangelizing very actively. Heinz told his sister, don't go there. She says, if you would have come and heard what I heard and seen what I have seen, you would come too. So Heinz thought about that for a while, and he was very much against it, but he finally felt, well, it can't hurt to go one time and find out what it's like, and then I'll know better what to talk against. So he went over there, and remember, he was still resolved, someday, sooner or later, I need to find out what these scriptures say. He went to the meeting, and he was deeply struck. One of the things that struck him was that one of the men that was there visiting, Jack Enta, was in the meeting, and he came up with him out the door as he was getting ready to leave in the dark, and he talked to him about his soul. How does it stand with your soul? And Heinz knew that it stood very bad with his soul. So he was ready to hear what this man had been saying, and he was deeply struck. Well, over this time, his sister needed to leave home because their parents were still nominally Catholic. They weren't very fierce Catholics, but there was enough fierce Catholics around that it wasn't safe for Elizabeth to stay home. So she decided to flee, and that almost did it on the wall now. At this point, the boundary between Austria and Germany was somewhere in here. Well, I'll do that on the thing. It was somewhere in here. And Niederlausitz, Oberlausitz was a German possession. In fact, at this point, they had lumped Lausitz in with a land that was right next to it called Sachsen. So this was here we have Sachsen-Anhalt, the Sachsen proper, and Niedersachsen were the next three, and up here, of course, is Brandenburg. Now, as they came over the border, and this was all mountainous territory, he helped Elizabeth escape. Another girl that he had met in this meeting was a very young girl. She's like 17 at the time, maybe not even 17. Her name was Katharina Ludwig. And she was in big trouble with her parents because her mom was such a strong Catholic that she told Katharina that if you go to this meeting and I catch you going there again, I will report you and you will go to jail. This mother and daughter. Because of the fact that Heinz had already been successful, he wasn't altogether successful. He helped Elizabeth over there, but the border guards caught him and threw him in jail. And they told him, if we catch you messing with the border again, this is the trouble. But since he was a very young fellow, they let him go. But then Katharina heard about Elizabeth getting over there safely, so she needed to go because her mom was on the verge of turning her in. So in the night, Heinz and Katharina, and he was like in his younger 20s, he was maybe 22 or something at this point, and the girl was about 17, Katharina. They fled out over the mountains in the woods, and this got to be pretty bad. She escaped, but there was, I think, 4 men on horseback and 2 on foot that were coming after him. And Heinz lay down somewhere, and she got away, and the fellows all passed him, and they didn't get caught. But Heinz realized that he is in big trouble now because they're on his trail, so he did not dare go back home. So after he made his way around, and this was in the fall of, I think, 1734, somewhere in that period of time. So he made his way over to Hanhut himself. And now, of course, he was without his parents, without his family and all that. He had made this sacrifice. And in Hanhut, one of the first Sundays that he was there, one of the choir leaders of the young men was a man by the name of Martin Doba. This man preached a powerful message on hypocrisy, religious hypocrisy, and what it is to be serious with Christ. To make the long story short, Heinz got converted at this meeting. And he got baptized and taken into the Moravian Church at that point, which was a turning point in his life, and he gave everything that he had to Christ and found out what the Scripture says. He found out through the living Word what the written Word says, and he wrote a good bit about that. Okay, now, their lives changed rapidly. As Heinz and not very long after Heinz and Katharina and Elizabeth were all over here in Hanhut, a series of events happened here. The Moravians all got driven out of Saxony. Now, this land right in here, Saxony or Saxony in German. They got driven out because the Lutherans didn't like them. Now, this was no longer the Catholics. This was the Lutherans that were getting nervous about what the Moravians are doing. So they chased as many of them as they could. They couldn't get them all out, but they chased a lot of them over into another part of Germany, which is over here. Now, this is going to be a little bit out of scale. I'll put down Frankfurt am Main. It's kind of bad to write on here. Frankfurt am Main. And just north of here, we have a region of Germany called the Wetterau. Now, they went over and mostly young people, and a couple of the leaders that were expelled legally, they went over to the Wetterau, and they found an old abandoned castle. This castle was called the Runneberg. Not one door worked in the whole castle. It had not been inhabited for years. The whole place was infested with rats. The outside was all grown up in brambles and briars. And here we had a couple of hundred people coming to sleep. Well, all they could do was sleep on the straw and hope for the best. Well, they had a lot of rats and problems and sickness and whatever. But they got the thing cleaned up and started working and planted crops. They're very industrious people. At this point, the Moravian Church held things fairly much in common, not like the Hutterites, but they had a very strong community. They had they divided the people into choirs. They loved to sing. So out of this idea, well, first of all, they had Benda. And these bands were that everyone that came to the church was given a companion. You don't be a lonely Christian in the Moravian church. Everybody gets a companion. And nobody appoints a companion. You find a person that you can feel comfortable with. Then you meet 2 or 3 times a week and you tell each other everything. The way it often began was, well, what do you see in me? And the other person says, well, what do you see in me? And so here they sat together and hashed things out a couple of times a week. And then they always prayed together. And many times these prayer meetings were at night. And incidentally, back at Hanhut, they also started praying at night on a regular basis, everybody taking turns, and praying around the clock all the time. You've probably heard about the 100-year prayer meeting. Well, that was sort of where it all began. Now, when they got over into the Runneberg, they kept on with this system, but here they had a larger system. First, they had the Bände, 2 or 3 or 4 people getting together a couple of times a week, but then they had all the young boys got together and were a fellowship on their own and lived in a house. Part of this was because of crowded conditions. They packed oodles of boys into one room and oodles of girls into another, and they had the married couples packed into, maybe they had curtains, I'm not sure, but into large rooms where they had them packed, and they had the children packed in a smaller room. This is an old castle, what could they do? So here they were, and then they had choir leaders. And these choir leaders, they led their groups in fellowship meals and prayers and so on among themselves. About once a month or oftener, they had general communions and fellowship meals. There's an awful lot of fellowship, and they loved to celebrate. And they did use musical instruments. I'm sorry for whoever doesn't like them. But they really were pretty great on that. Okay, so here they were. Their life settled down somewhat here in Frankfurt am Main area in the Ronneberg. And then they moved into another castle. As their group expanded rapidly, they were sending out letters all over the place and getting visitors all over the place. And so their group grew very large. And they weren't there too terrible long until both Heinz and Katharina found a companion. The way people got married in the Moravian church is that the church looked over people that they thought looked like suitable candidates. Or if there were people that needed to go somewhere, like young people that would send out to a new place or want to have some work done, it might be good if a young man would have a young woman to accompany him. You know, just might look better. It might work out better all around. So the church took it upon themselves to have a day when we had getting married day. And here, all the young people that needed to get married, they'd come up front, and they had a little dish with blank slips of paper and some papers that said ja and some papers that said nein. And first of all, they got the you know, they drew a paper which said whether you're going to get married or not, for sure. And then once that was around, it's done different ways. This one way of doing it. And then they had slips of paper, and usually a boy was given like two or three candidates. And then and always some blanks in with it, too. And so he'd fish around in there and pull out a name, and presto, we get married. That was the courtship. But the idea was that everybody was so wholeheartedly given over to Christ that it didn't matter who you married. Because, of course, you wouldn't put someone a name in the bowl that wasn't fit to get married. These were all people that their spiritual caliber had been tested. And believe me, it worked marvelously. They had occasions when there was 30 or 40 or even up to 50-some couples getting married on one day. So here you had a lot of newlyweds. And on one situation, well, I'll get into that later, where there's a whole shipload of newly marrieds came to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. But here they were, and both Heinz got a girl. Her name was Lisbeth Peksha, I think was her name, Lisbeth Peksha. And the other one, Katharina, she also came over from Schlesien. She got a boy by the name of Joachim Sensemann. Now, their paths at this time parted, because a week following this marriage, Heinz Beutel and Heinz and Lisbeth Beutel were sent off to Suriname in South America to begin a new Moravian colony in South America. And this, of course, in those days was not so easy. The journey took them 8 months, if I'm not mistaken. They went down the river here, down into the Rhine, and got over into the Netherlands. And from there, they waited on a ship that would take them down to South America. When they got to South America, they discovered, of course, the horrors of the slave trade, which was something totally new to these German people at Schlesien. And they discovered the Indians. At this point, the Moravians' work in South America was largely confined to working with the Indians far in the interior. Now, these Indians had never met, a great many of them had never met white people before. As I told you, they got married 8 months on the voyage. By the time they got there, Lisbeth was about to have their first baby. So when they got to Suriname, she was feeling awful. And on top of that, the weather was just powerfully hot. They had no idea things could be this hot in this world. And they wrote letters back home and said, we aren't wearing our woolen underwears. And different things of this nature. And said, people here, they grow stuff all year around. And they don't eat potatoes or whatever we're reading over there. They eat something that they pull out of the ground. What it turned out to be was yucca, cassava. All sorts of strange things. Said the snakes here are about 14 feet long and as thick as, I forget what they said. I think it's a man's leg, I think, or something like that. These kind of things, the stories that they wrote back home. But here they got down, I think it was 15 hours on the boat and 20-some hours on foot. That they went back, well, now I'm going to have to get it. Well, I'm not sure if I'll make a map on that. I'm going to lose too much time. They were back on a river called the Barbice. Berbice it's spelled, but it's pronounced Barbice, which is now on the western side of Guyana. At this point, it was a Dutch colony. They went up with a couple of other men. One young man by the name of Johan something. Well, we'll just call him Johan. There's Johann and Joachim. Let's see, this was Heinz and Lisbeth, and this young fellow, Johann, went up the river and started going out to visit. Now, there's also a Funk girl along. She's a San Elizabeth Casca Funk. That was from Pennsylvania. She was down and married a fellow named Casca. So there was a couple of Moravians back. Their idea was to build a Christian community in the wilderness for the Indians. And believe me, it worked. They went up there and started going out on long distances into the woods and meeting these Indians. Well, these Indians were very surprised to see people from Germany. They had never seen white people before, let alone people that come along with great big bushy beards. So what usually happened, the men were out hunting, and they'd come across an Indian camp, and the ladies would all throw up their arms and scream and leave. So they had a lot of convincing to do, but Heinz and Lisbeth, incidentally, her baby was born, and I think it died not too long afterward. But she recovered, and they took in a child as was sort of a half-breed. I think it was half Indian and half black, because the Dutch had already had a lot of black slaves. A young fellow by the name of Jantje. And they took this fellow in, and this fellow knew the Indian language, so he started telling them how you say things in Indian. So Heinz and this Johann and a couple of other fellows that were with him, they would write down things in the Arawak Indian language, and they'd come back with a piece of paper to get to an Indian camp, and they'd read off their papers, and sometimes it had positive effects. Not always. But once in a while, they got into a place where it was fairly receptive. One of the villages, another problem that they ran into is that the Indians back in there, they wore paint, and they wore strings around their ankles and their wrists and stuff, but they hadn't gotten on to the practice of wearing clothes. And so here, this was, of course, something unusual for the people coming straight out of Germany. But they managed to negotiate that. And what they did, they got to this little Indian village called Baharuda. And in this village, they read over their little piece, and Jantje helped him to tell in very simple language the story of Christ. These Moravians felt, you don't go around and preach a lot of theology at people or try to tell them about the existence of God. They felt that is innate in all men, that all men already know that God exists. So all that we need to do is to tell them that the Creator, for whom and by whom all things are created, has come to the world and died as a ransom so that our sins could be forgiven. That is what they preached. Modern-day missionaries would say, well, what a way to start with pagans. You don't just go and tell them that about Christ dying on the cross. How are they ever going to understand? Well, I don't know. I guess it was the grace of God that worked with him. These people started understanding. They got to this village of Wakaruna and started reading this little story that they'd all written down. And the people tell them, hey, read that again. So they read it again. And then he said, let's hear that again. And so they read it again. And this just kept on and on and on. And finally, the fellows were getting exhausted, and they had been on very poor food, and they were soaked wet, and it was raining a lot back there in the jungle. And finally, they couldn't go on anymore, but this Gravenstein, that's what his name was, Johann Gravenstein, he went down, and there was one very old lady sat in the circle, and an old, old wrinkled lady, and she said, these are my sons, and these are my son's sons, and these are my son's son's sons. And so they knew that she was already a great-grandmother. Well, she was there, and she got a couple of things across to this Jantje, this interpreter, and she told Johann Gravenstein, said, I can't hear very good. And said, you come sit down beside me and read that thing again. And so Johann Gravenstein sat beside her and read it over and over and over and over. And she just wanted to hear this story. They were making connections. These Indians had a talk about God, who had been in South America at one point, and I guess their God, whatever they called him, had a name for him. And this God had told him, one day I'm going to send my son, and he will tell you what you're supposed to do. That was one of the things that they'd had. And all of a sudden, they were making connections here. This just might be this. So she was there, and she said, I want to go where you go. And the Moravians at that point had built a little colony with a number of little houses in a circle on the Barbice River in Guyana. They called it Pilgahut, which means the watch of the pilgrims, the pilgrim's watch. This old lady said, I want to go and live with you there at the pilgrim's watch. They said, we're sorry. This place is I don't know how many days it was in the jungle. It was at least maybe 3.5 days on jungle trail. Said, you can't come. And the old lady could hardly walk. So they said, there's no way, but we're glad to tell you what we can tell you. And they kind of tried to make her as happy as they could. And they set off back home. Well, to their great surprise, a couple of weeks later, who should they see But this old lady come tottering in with a couple of sticks, and some of her grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren were with her and helping her along. And this old lady comes tottering in, and she says, "I want to be washed in the blood." Now, isn't that a strange thing for a South American Indian to say? That hasn't had any other contact with white people. And she says, "Not only do I want to be washed in the blood, I want to be washed from here to here." She showed from the top of her head to the bottom of her feet. She wanted to be washed. So these people said, "What can we do? If that isn't a request of baptism, what is it?" So they baptized her. They put on, they made a simple a linen shift, like a kind of a dress, and they baptized this old lady, and they gave her a Christian name, and they called her Hannah. Now, she was the very first convert that the Moravians had in South America. Now, I could tell you many, many stories about how this went, with their sicknesses, their disease, their snakes, their Indian attacks, their black attacks, but I can't get into a lot of the story. But I will tell you this much. Hannah attracted more people. And all of a sudden, and they would have their love feasts out there in the dark, because they had their love feasts in the evenings, like the early Christians. They'd be out there around a big bonfire, a big campfire out in the dark. And this was way down in the heart of Guyana. Believe me, this place is still just like that. If you get back in fact, there's no roads going there to this day. You can get back in on a boat, partways up the Barbies, but I'm not even sure how far you can really even go. But there's no people living back in there at all anymore at this time, neither whites nor Indians. But at that point, it was all virgin jungle. And here they had their love feasts out in the dark around the fire and would celebrate this for quite a number of hours. They were great for having long services. And I don't think they slept much in services either. I don't know. Here they were. And as they were around the fire, they would see these painted people coming up in behind out of the dark. The shadows would come slipping in. And the group would get larger and larger and larger every evening, and they would sing these songs, and pretty soon these people were singing their songs along with them, and they started learning the language. And as this thing grew, they started having their young people. There was a very neat difference between the ones that were converted and the ones that weren't. The unconverted didn't wear clothes, and the ones that were converted did. And so in their church service, you could pretty well tell who was a member and who wasn't. The young men, they started having a young man's choir and a young lady's choir on one side and on the other side. The old Hannah sat in the hammock under a roof. And as these numbers grew, she lived to see the day, old Hannah, until every single one of her living descendants was converted. And the Moravians were not these kind of people that lightly baptized people or that lightly said, "Hey, you're okay, we'll just take you in." They were people that took their folks through a very scrutinous period of, are you real or aren't you? Do you know Christ or do you not? And it was until the whole congregation sensed that here was a person that had been struck by the wounds of the Lamb, that they accepted him in. And then oftentimes it was a year or maybe even a couple of years after baptism until they got communion for the first time. They were very careful about who they accepted to communion. But here they were, and this church grew in leaps and bounds. In fact, there was hundreds and hundreds of members, and eventually these members started traveling long distances. Some went overland over to the Orinoco Valley in Venezuela, and some were gone like for periods of 4 or 5 years. And then they would come back and bring a whole bunch more Indians along with them. And the thing was going pretty good. But over this period of time, Heinz and Lisbeth, they had a couple of children, and they felt that this is not quite right to our children, that they aren't getting more of an education. We really should do something. So what they decided to do with their children is take them up to Bethlehem in Pennsylvania so they could spend some time with others of their kind and not only learn from the Indians. It's good to learn how to live in the bush and all this, but they felt they should also learn some other things. So Heinz and Lisbeth set out in a ship, and they came up to Pennsylvania. Now, to us at this point, that sounds like this must have really been a homecoming and a coming back to a civilized state. In Pennsylvania in the 1750s, 1755, I think is the year that they came up, it was not what it is now. At this point, they were just entering the French and Indian War. Now, I'll just bring you up to this point in Pennsylvania. They came up to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which was another Moravian settlement. Here, Heinz got reacquainted with Lisbeth, Katharina Ludwig, remember her? She was the girl that he had helped out across the border years earlier. Katharina Ludwig, at this point, had come to Pennsylvania to start a new colony at that point. She had come over on the first sea congregation, is what they called it. The Moravians called it Zegemeinde, which is a congregation on the sea that elected a whole bunch of people. And they did this numerous times, where they had all a large group of young people, and they would elect them all to go over to the new country and build a new congregation in the new land. And sometimes they got married before they went, sometimes they waited until after. But the whole way across the Atlantic on this ship, the crew, of course, were the young fellows that learned how to manage a sailing ship coming across. The thing strictly segregated, right down the middle of the ship. Ladies stay on this side, men on this side. Ladies sleep over here, men over here, like they did in their services. In fact, in their services, they had segregated seating, not like we have today, with a wall down the middle so that both sides could see the minister, but they couldn't see each other. That's how it was. And so there wasn't a whole lot of monkey business. But they got across on the ocean and settled in there. And at this point, they were just starting to work with the Indians along the Hudson River in New York. So when Katharina had come over, roughly the same time that Heinz had gone to South America, she and her husband, Joachim Sensemann, went up to New York on the Hudson River and started working with the Mohicans. You ever hear of the last of the Mohicans? Well, supposedly he was a Moravian. But there's a number of Moravians or a number of Mohican Indians that had gotten converted. They lived at a little place that they called Shekomeko on the Hudson River. These people lived there for about, 10 years until the authorities in New York drove them out. Because they would not fight nor swear oaths, it was considered expedient that these people should leave the province of New York at that point. It was a British province. They could not stay in New York for not doing those things. So they went to Connecticut for a while. And as this was going on, Katharina learned the Indian language. She learned to speak Mohican and Mohawk, if I understand correctly. And she was over in Connecticut for a while at a place called Gnadden Zay, which is the Lake of Grace. They loved to include the name of Grace in their terms. After so long, the Indians were being persecuted there. The Christian Indians were being persecuted. So they brought them all down to Bethlehem. And said, we've got to find a place for these people. Up from Bethlehem, I'm not sure how many of you are acquainted with Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. It's north of between Allentown and Easton, north of Philadelphia. Up the Lehigh River, where the Delaware and the Lehigh come together. These folks had founded a very thriving settlement. There also they had this system where the young people lived in one place, the young men here and the young sisters here and the widows here. Incidentally, the Moravians were very, very modest. And if you think that pietists don't have church standards, you don't know what you're talking about. These were pietists that did. They had a very detailed, it was pages and pages of what you were to do and what you were not to do. Very interesting type of church standards. Like, for instance, when you go to town, be sure to let everybody else in the community know so that they can also order stuff with you when you're coming back. And as far as their dress standard and their modesty was concerned, they were extremely modest. In fact, I was just out there not too long ago, and the tour guide said that, unfortunately, our sisters back in those days dressed in capes and aprons and dresses that were so long that they often hung into the fire when they were tending their pots, and many sisters got burnt. And he was thinking this was some kind of big stroke against plain clothes. Well, I'm not sure if that really was the way it was. I guess it might have had something to do with it. But here they were. And as far as their coverings, I was going to tell you a little bit about that. They had nothing about all this hair sticking out the front of their coverings because they wore three-piece coverings. And one of them was a little cap covering on the back of the head, sort of like the River Brethren ladies wear. And it had two loops down here where you'd stuck a ribbon through. And this ribbon was a big long thing about that long and very wide. And this was stuck through the two loops and tied down here. If you were a very little girl, the ribbon was pink. No, it was red. And then if you were a little bit older girl, once you got converted, I think it changed into pink. And then once you got married, it turned into blue. And once you were a widow, it turned white. And so you could tell the status, whether you were converted, unconverted, married, or single, at a glance as to the color of your covering string. And then they had the third piece of the covering was a big white band with strings at the back that was tied under the hair bun. And that was to take care of all those hair that stick out the front. Now, by the time it all got said and done, it made no difference how they did their hair, nicer or fancy or unfancy, because you couldn't see one single hair. It's the way it was. Now, here they were. They're a very plain group of people. The men wore like Amish-type hats. And these Indians that came in, they also took on to this plain way of dress. In fact, Indians and blacks. So here we had blacks getting converted, and they were sitting there with their very modest clothes. And Indians and people from South America and Greenland Eskimos, because at that time they were in Greenland. They were also in Sri Lanka, which is Ceylon, and had gotten over to the Nicobar Islands, which is close to the East Indies. And so they had a large variety of people together besides Europeans. In fact, in their early love feasts at Bethlehem, they would sing certain songs in as many as, I think it was 14 or 15 different languages of the dialects and languages that people had. And then there were always some represented that didn't get their song sung. But in this situation, these Indians came from New York, these refugee Indians, and they decided we're going to need to do something for them to keep them safe from the whites, because the whites at this point were trying to exterminate the Indians during preliminary to the French and Indian War. They settled the Indians on a place up the Lehigh River at a place called the Mahoney Creek. This is the modern-day site of Lehighton, Pennsylvania. If you know where Lehigh Valley Dairy is, Lehighton, if you know anything about that place, it's a big steel smelting town at this point. Well, I guess the steel smelter has kind of died down. It's just out of the Lehigh Water Gap where you come north of Bethlehem. There's a mountain crossing the Lehigh River, sort of like the mountains cross the Susquehanna with a big gap down the middle. Just on the far side of this Lehigh Water Gap, there's a little creek called the Mahoney. On this place, they built a mill. They built a gemeine house, which was their general house where the brothers and sisters slept and the married couples. And where they also had a big communal dining room downstairs where they would eat their supper. Katharina Ludwig Sensemann and her husband Joachim and their three children, the first one is called Gutlope, but I forget what the other two were. They went up to live at this new Indian settlement since they knew the Indian language and had worked with the Indians a good bit in the past. They were there. And as the situation became more and more dangerous, the Pennsylvania Scotch-Irish militia, the Scotch-Irish, Pennsylvania was under a Quaker government supposedly at this point, and the Quakers would not fight the Indians, but the Scotch-Irish, they did. They were coming around and they were saying, "You Moravians are not safe. Up there past the Lehigh Water Gap, the hostile French-influenced Indians could get you any time." But the Moravians said, "Well, we won't fight. We'll just be here and we'll be peaceable and we'll have to take in stride whatever comes." So here they were. But the time did come when Katharina and her husband thought for the best of their family, they better send their three children down to Bethlehem. So their children were down to Bethlehem on November the 24th, 1755, when things began to happen. There were Joachim was sitting at the supper table, in fact, all of them. Now, Katharina did not happen to be at the supper table because she wasn't feeling well. She was upstairs in her room. But Joachim was sitting at the table with the rest, and someone mentioned, "You know, I wonder if we lock the saal." The saal was like their meeting room where they got together. And someone thought, "You better go out and you just hook that door because we don't want all sorts of things to get in during the night. And also, we never know who could be there, so we'll just hook the door on the saal." So they went. Joachim went out to check on the door and see what that was going. While he was out, he heard some gunshots. He didn't know exactly what it was. He thought it might be some of the Pennsylvania militia because they had been around all day. But he thought he'll just observe for a little bit and see what happened. In the meantime, the other people that were sitting around the supper table, they had been hearing the dogs bark and some footsteps pounding outside. So a couple of the men got up and were going to see what happened. Some went to the windows and some went to the door. The person that went to the door was a young Englishman by the name of Joseph Sturgis. Some of the other men that went to the door, there's a Martin Presser. There was a Martin Nitschmann went to the door. And his wife, Susanna Nitschmann, was sitting at the table. Also a young couple that had come from Germany. In fact, Martin Nitschmann was one of the fellows that had come all the way down here from Bohemia, or Moravia. He had come up into Hamhut years earlier, and he had also been sent over to Pennsylvania as a young man. So he went to the door, and as the door opened, they were expecting to see Pennsylvania militia. But instead of that, guess what they saw? Here was a brown arm comes in the door. As soon as this door opens a crack, a brown arm comes in, and a rifle comes in, and kabang! And Martin Nitschmann falls down dead. And just like that, another volley of shots and another three men fall down dead. And by that time, there was no question. And they all took for the stairs. Susanna Nitschmann was wounded in one of the first volleys. And she made it about halfway up the stairs. Then she slipped and fell back. And the others that got upstairs, they heard her say something about their brothers, "Come help me," or something of that nature. But that's the last they saw of her. And they figured the Indians probably got her. But these were Indians, and they were not friendly Indians. They were French Indians that had come in from the north. And here what happened is they went upstairs. in the very room where Katharina was in there, she was not feeling well. And the last thing that they remembered her saying, because these Indians were down there and they heard them rummaging around in the house, and they had locked the door behind them when they went upstairs, but they knew that this wouldn't last. And the Indians were shooting up through the floor, so all sorts of things were happening upstairs. But then they started hearing, for a little bit there was silence. And then they started hearing the roar of flames downstairs, and they knew what they had come in. So there was a young man by the name of a Parch lady. She was a daring lady. I think her name was Louisa Parch. And her husband had been gone on an errand, so he wasn't there either. So she was there, and there's a Fabricus, another young man, and yet another man. I think his name was Plesser. And they jumped out the window. So they figured, well, it can't be worse outside. They knew there was Indians outside, but we got to do something. So this one lady, this Louisa Parch, and this Plesser and the Fabricus jumped outside. And this was dark outside, too. When Louisa came down to the ground, she quick hid behind a bush, but she didn't know what happened to the one fellow that got away. But she saw the Indians coming around the corner of the house, and she saw them shoot down this one of the young men and scalp him right in front of her eyes. And she didn't know what to do or where to go, but she was behind the bush. And the last thing that they had heard Susanna say upstairs was, "Liebe Heiland, das wisste ich." Dear Savior, I knew this would happen. Das habe ich mir gedacht. I think that's what she said. "Liebe Heiland, das habe ich mir gedacht." I thought this would happen, but she wasn't saying it reproachfully. See, she was, for years before this, she had a sensation that somehow or another her life would need to end here among these Indians. Another couple that was upstairs was an enter couple, and they had a small baby, and the lady with the baby, she had wrapped the baby up in her arms. She said she's not jumping out the window because she doesn't feel that she can't jump with the baby. She wouldn't get away anyway. So she was up in there, and her husband decided to stay with her. And there was a Peter Vorbas was in another house close by, and he heard this baby as the flames were going up and the house burned down. Some of the other folks then had escaped, and the Indians around there, they all took into the woods as fast as they could. But now, down in Bethlehem, Heinz Beutel was there, and as this news came filtering down that the Indians are coming, they didn't know what they should do. Some folks thought they should get armed. Among them, there was the people that had come in up from southern Pennsylvania, people Reformed, Lutheran background. But they decided, we have lived this way, we will stand this way, and whatever the Indians do can't be helped. Whatever the Pennsylvania militia wants to do, that's their problem. So Heinz was there, and he was keeping watch for 3 months, taking his turn day and night, keeping watch for when the Indians come, so at least they could flee. But the Indians never did make it down to Bethlehem. There's some other events that took place. At the end of the 3 months, their time had come that they would need to leave their children in Nazareth at that point. It was north of Bethlehem. It was a little town of Nazareth. And they went back to South America. They sailed back to South America. Heinz and Lisbeth, without their children. They got back to South America, and lo and behold, well, they were starting a new settlement on another river further east. This time they were not working among the Indians as much because that work was already going strong. Now they were working with a group of black people that had escaped from the Dutch masters. They were called the Bush Negroes. I'm not sure if you ever heard about the Bush Negroes. A Bas Negro, they're called in Dutch. There were a whole bunch of people that had revolted against their black masters and had taken off back into the woods and were a very fierce kind of people. Not only were they dead set against any white man, a white face shows up, we ask no question. These people had guns and they shot them right off. That was their philosophy for whites, their policy. On top of that, they were very superstitious. They had come from Africa. By now, they spoke some kind of an English dialect. English, imagine, because they had learned it from the English slave masters. There were a lot of English slave masters in the Dutch colony. Don't ask me how that worked, but it was. And anyway, here they were. They're speaking this rough dialect, and they were devil worshippers. They had all manner of sacrifices and demons that they worshipped to. Their whole lives revolved around witchcraft. A couple by the name of Rudolf Stahl married a girl by the name of Eva Penner. From Germany. Eva Penner was from the northern Vistula Delta area. I don't know if she had Mennonite connections or not, but she certainly had a Mennonite name. Here she came down to Rudolf Stahl, who was a Moravian brother from Switzerland. That couple and Heinz and Lisbeth Beutel decided to go up this river and see if they could make friends with these black people. Well, they didn't get shot. They managed to get to know some people out in the field, to introduce themselves to the point that they realize these white people coming in are not slave owners, they're not the kind that are going to take us back to Paramaribo and put us back into bondage. So they allowed them to live, but that is about it. They were as mean to them as they could possibly be and tried to do all manner of things and cast spells on them and or dance around their house at night and whatever to keep them from sleeping and didn't give them food, made sure they didn't have anything else that they needed. And they certainly hoped that they would get the hint and leave. But they were there and telling these people at any opportunity what they could about Christ. Here was this man, one of these black men that was back in there, by the name of Arabini. This man decided he's going to do an experiment on their god. One of their gods, the most powerful god that they had, was a crocodile that lived in the river. He decided he's going to go down with his shotgun early in the morning, and he's going to tell this crocodile god, "Crocodile, if you're God, you'll get away from me. And if you're not, I'm going to shoot you and you're going to die." So he went down and he shot. And guess what happened? The crocodile died. Well, guess what happened to him? The people were ready to skin him alive. "You've killed our God." Arabini, on the other hand, was convinced, "This is all a bunch of nothing. We are scared of nothing. These demons can't hurt us. These gods can't do anything for us. We're not worshiping the right God. Maybe those white people down there know what they're talking about." So he came down, and the things started happening, and from one thing to another. He got baptized. They called him Johannes. Johannes Arabini, he was known for the rest of his life, became a very powerful preacher among the Moravians. And so it was him. Incidentally, I should mention that the Indians up in New York State, the ones that escaped the massacre there on the Mahoney Creek, they went down to Philadelphia and ended up out west in Tuscarawas Valley in Ohio and built a very flourishing Indian community out there. Many, many, many got converted in those days when the Moravians told people about Christ. This black mission took off in a very good way. Heinz and Lisbeth were there for a number of years until they went back to the Kamavayana River and to the Kataka River and finally back over close to the Barbese again. And here was a chain of other settlements that grew up in the woods. Some of them were part Indian and some of them were part black. Well, this went on until about the 1760s sometime, until all of a sudden there was a major black revolt down the river on the Barbese by a man named Cuffy. Here this Cuffy was a very clever black slave. He knew Dutch extremely well. This was a Dutch colony along the Barbese River at that point. He knew Dutch well enough that he could read. He could do all sorts of things. He knew how to govern. He knew what the governor did up there in his palace in Fort Nassau, which is now New Amsterdam, the city of New Amsterdam in Guyana. So he rounded up whoever he could get on his side, and they overtook the white colony, the Dutch white colony on the Barbese River. Well, the Boitels were living upstream a long ways among the blacks and among the Indians. And these blacks downstream did not trust these white people upstream. So they came up there and they were clearing everybody out as they went. So the Boitels decided they should flee. So here they were and fled for, I forget how long a time this must have been. It was, maybe a couple of weeks or something that they fled through the woods and went over toward the Demerara River. And in the process, well, of course, their colony was burnt down. They escaped with the skin of their teeth. And as they were going through the woods, one of their party, which was an older man, also had come from Germany, going across in a rotten log. The log broke down and he fell into the river, but they fished him back out and kept on going until they got over to Demerara. By that time, they were totally exhausted. And by this time, of course, Heinz and Lisbeth were very much worn out from all their years in South America and so forth. And so they finally got their way down to Stabroek, which is now the city of Georgetown, Guyana. And there they took shipping and went back to Europe. They got shipwrecked on the way over on the coast of the Netherlands and ended up being cast ashore on the island of Schouwen-Duiveland and made their way overland back to Helmhout, got there, and 5 days later, Heinz died. That's the end of his life. Now, Heinz wrote his story, and like I said, I didn't get into much detail, but he wrote his story, and at the end of it all, it winds it up with this thought: I needed to find out what the scriptures say. This is what happened. Here he was, all these people in all these places. This was back in the 1730s and the 40s, when things were not easy. It was hard to get around. Very few of us have been to these places in the jungle in South America, or into the wilds of North America, which of course the wilds aren't really so wild anymore, into Europe traveling around. These people did. Those people got around, they got it done, because they were led by the way of Christ. Now, the reason I'm telling you this story is that it's something totally different. And it's not so much the details of the story, although I like the story myself. It's what these people did with their stories. The Moravians had a concept that nothing is unimportant. Every event in our lives is calculated. We choose. We are free agents. They believe strongly that we're not predestination folks. They believe that we make decisions that affect every area of our lives, and every moment, every hour is important. So all our lives long as Christians, we need to be writing down, recording in an orderly manner what's happening to us. This is what they call the Lebenslauf. I'll write this on here, see if you can see that. Lebenslauf. What happened? This is the walk of your life. What happened with these Lebensläufe? People wrote how they came to seek after God, how they found God, how they walked with Him, all the things that happened, the good and the bad. And believe me, there's often a lot of bad. And I can't imagine these Lebensläufe, how they get into explicit detail about telling, you know, how this happened in the church and what they all had to work through and all. A very honest record, I feel, like Edsel was talking about, not covering over details. Every person wrote a Lebenslauf. At the end of the Lebenslauf, do you know what summed it up? It was the Heimgang. This was the next part. The Moravians did not talk about dying and funerals and burials. They talked about going home. The Heimgang. The very first Heimgang that Heinz and Lisbeth celebrated down among the Indians in South America was an impressive one. It was a very old man died, and about 5 minutes later, one of their oldest sisters died. It wasn't Hannah. Another one died sooner. But here they were, and these people that had been very superstitious. All of a sudden, they had caught on to what fellowship with Christ is, and they had a joyful funeral. The Moravians believed in joyful funerals to a certain extent. They didn't mind if people cried because of the separation. But it was basically a celebration, and there was musical instruments. There was they carried palm branches. They laid the body to rest. With a festive air, this person has finally been able to go home. The Heimgang summed up the Lebenslauf, and then what the funeral message was the Lebenslauf itself. What the person that wrote all his life about himself, the choir leader, at the end summed up how the person died, and then the whole thing was read off at the end. This is storytelling at its best because of the influence that it had on all the rest. And these Lebensläufe were collected together. At this point, there are reams of Lebensläufe, like from me to the back end of that wall. Files and files and files and files of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people that wrote their life story in German longhand. It's an amazing library. I don't know of anything like it, neither before nor since. That is why I wanted to tell you about it. If any one of you knows how to read German, go to Bethlehem. Now, in Bethlehem, they don't have near all of them, but they have them in vaults. And, of course, many Moravians now can't read German anymore. And incidentally, the Moravian Brethren is an example of the fact that a group of people can have a tremendous vision and lose it dramatically. They have lost it, I'm afraid. In fact, I think many of themselves would say that they have lost it. But so at this point, don't expect anything all that dramatic if you go to Bethlehem. Although many of the older buildings are still there. I'm talking Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. There's also a large collection of Lebensläufe for this type of manuscripts over in Herrnhut in Germany, where many of the ones that never got to America got into those files. The purpose of this was to be a living witness, the life story witness to the rest of the people that are behind. As these were brought across, many, many people got converted on the testimony of others that had gotten converted. It was a thing that went from one to another, a spreading thing. For a number of years in there, the Moravians were one of the fastest growing bodies in Christendom. In fact, maybe the fastest growing. They were definitely the first people that went around. Incidentally, this church that the Beutels founded down there in Suriname, within a space of not too many years, counted around 23,000 members. It was, in fact, it was one of the largest Moravian churches anywhere. Now, as I'm talking about storytelling, I don't know how much I need to explain, but as I told you this story about Heinz and Lisbeth, maybe you got a small introduction as to who these people were, where they came from, and what they did. What does it take to use that equipment, that tool, as we are teaching our children in school? I personally feel that storytelling is very important. I don't like doing it like today, when we need to get together and we have schedules and, okay, now you tell me a story. I don't like that kind of thing. I like spontaneous storytelling. I do feel that all teachers need to be storytellers. If you need to know about the worth of storytelling, look at Christ. What did he do? He told stories, and the way that we identify with the characters in the story is he presents the character in such a way that we realize that person had some affinity with us. We don't worry so much about the teller as about the character in the story. Now, I'm not sure how well I am able to accomplish this. I don't think I'm an expert at this, but some storytellers are able, story writers also, are able to get me involved in that person's life, the character of the story, to the extent that it does not matter what he does, I'm going to stick up for him. It's a little bit like drama. Now, I don't care much for drama, but we went to an evangelical drama in Costa Rica at one point, and they had these folks up there enacting the crucifixion and the life of Christ and all this. Well, the only problem was that the man that they had to represent Christ wasn't much of a good actor. He was there and just kind of shuffling around, didn't act like he knew what he was doing. But the fellow that represented Satan was a very handsome young man, and believe me, he knew what he was doing. And he was up there and he stole the show. And so here it was, Lucifer was there from the beginning to the end, the whole congregation. And I talked with people afterwards, everybody just wasn't that quite something the way that Lucifer could do things. What... You see the problem? Mixed signals. The whole thing was just totally wrong. And here we had, everybody felt this affinity for the Lucifer in the story. And the Christ was kind of wiped off the scene. This is what happens in storytelling if we're not careful. We need to be sure that the point that is being made in the story is being done with characters that the audience or the ones that are reading the story are going to identify with and like. Unless you like the character, you're not going to care what he does. But once I get you wrapped around my fingers if I'm telling you a story, and you kind of feel for a character and you sort of wish the best for him, then all of a sudden I have that character doing whatever I want and you're following right along behind. That is telling a story. As teachers, what can we do with storytelling? I don't know that we can even teach a history class. And here, I don't know that, I think people don't tell stories because they think you have to be a professional. Well, the reason that people tell stories, like me, for instance, because we're not professionals. It's all we can do. I mean, here we are. We don't have any degrees behind our name. Didn't you notice when what's his name was given an introduction this morning, and he says this fellow studied so and so, and that one did this and that. Well, he doesn't say that about me, because it's just not the case. I'm this farm boy that comes around and I read a couple of books once in a while, and here. All I can do is tell stories. Well, all I can tell is more or less the way it was. And whether I do a good job or a bad job of it, I don't know. That has something to do with it. But it's basic in knowing the facts and building up an affinity with the character. I think the one of the first things about affinity is I need to have an affinity with the character. Unless I can identify with the character myself, it's going to be very hard for me to have anyone else do it through a story that I'm telling. But as we go through this and we tell stories, let us remember that a well-told story is like a picture. It is more than 1,000 words of theory. We can get up and talk about how things are supposed to work and theories, theology, all this, until the story comes along, it may not clinch. I'm sorry I didn't bring a book in from the car. I have a book out there which is a remarkable case. It's a book of Hasidic stories that are told by Jewish people in Argentina. It's published in Spanish, and it's all stories of how good Jews and bad Jews lived over the ages. The winning character in the story is always a Jew that kept the law. And the bad guy is always a fellow that cut corners on the law, wasn't careful, made compromises with Gentiles, and look at what happened to him. But the marvelous part of the thing is that the stories are adapted. You can easily see Latin American Spanish, Catholic Spanish coming through the whole thing. But the stories are as Jewish as they ever were, and the point is still being made. No group of people has ever been in existence for a long period of time without a body of stories. None. Christianity could not exist without stories. If all that you would know is the theology of St. Paul, there would be no Christians left to tell the tale. The reason that Christianity took on was because Christ told stories. Paul told stories. People came around, talked about actual people. Paul's letters are very personable. Bring me the books or bring me the coat or whatever it was. You can read it between the lines. It's not some article like you're reading out of Lifelines or the Christian Contender or something like that. Someone writes a nice detailed treatise on a certain subject. Not at all the way it was. It was these people that did this, that did that, that did the other. And in with it comes the theology. You as teachers, men and women, may be the greatest teachers and preservers of Anabaptist theology. Unless you know the story, and unless you are able to tell it to your students, it may be lost. Once the stories are lost, the belief is lost, and finally, the people are lost. I'll just have to close with one scripture. In Matthew 13, verse 34, we have a little bit of an inkling as to how Christ did this. All things spake Jesus unto the multitude in parables, and without a parable spake he not unto them, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables, I will utter things which have been kept secret from the foundation of the world. Without parables he spake not unto them, and without parables and without stories, I don't think we should attempt to teach our children.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.